Our mission is to bring you an unbiased discussion on the technological development and application of unmanned aerial systems in our airspace. UAS Today.
Hey folks, welcome to the show. I'm your host, Michael Garrity. We've got a great show lined up for you today. A little bit later, we'll be speaking with Mr. Thomas Meyer. He is the president of the U.S. subsidiary Air Robot. We'll also be discussing some current news and events that have been going on with unmanned aerial systems. Just a reminder, you can check us out at uas-today.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter.
Support and funding for this podcast has been made possible by the Vodnoy Group. The Vodnoy Group, supporting arts and culture through charitable donations. If you or your company would like to sponsor an episode of UAS Today, please contact us at podcast@uas-today.com.
All right, folks, before we get started with today's phone interview with Mr. Thomas Meyer, I want to talk about current news that's going on with unmanned aerial systems in our national airspace. As many of you know, last week somebody landed a small unmanned aerial system on the lawn of the White House. This was not done intentionally, it was by accident. It was not part of a demonstration or anything else like that. The point is that we need to be careful when using our unmanned aerial systems. As my audience knows, I am a proponent of the use of unmanned aerial systems in our national airspace. I think that hobbyists should be allowed to use them. I think that commercial organizations should be allowed to use them. And I think that research groups should be allowed to use them. However, when incidents like this happens, it tends to cast a negative light on their use. Whenever we hear about pilots seeing an unmanned aerial system near an airport, and things like that, it has the tendency to cast a negative light, as I was saying. So I think we need to practice a certain amount of restraint when we're using these. We need to fly, hobbyists need to fly unmanned aerial systems in designated areas like they do with model aircrafts. We should not be using these things recklessly, because when that happens, we have these incidents such as unmanned aerial systems landing on the White House lawn. So I'd like all my listeners who own a small UAS or plan to own a small UAS to practice restraint while they're using them. We'll be right back with our phone interview after this. My guest today is Mr. Thomas Meyer. He is the president of the U.S. subsidiary Air Robot. Mr. Meyer, thank you for being with us today on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about Air Robot.
Our company, Air Robot, is a manufacturer of small unmanned aerial systems. Our headquarters are based in Germany, and the company was also founded in Germany. The company goes back quite a long way, so we sometimes like to say we're going back to the Stone Age of the industry. The first of our systems were actually designed and built in 2004. That is now 10 years ago. And they were invented by our founder and our current owner, Mr. Vigerich. At the time, the idea did not seem really as a great business case, because the capabilities were quite limited. Still, we did find our first customers, and then from there on did constant improvements, were growing actually organically, so we were still privately held. And in 2006, we formed a subsidiary in the United States, which is owned by Air Robot, and I'm currently the president of the U.S. subsidiary.
Who were some of the clients of Air Robot when the company first started?
We had two kinds of clients. We had, on one side, we had the aerial photographers. These were the typical small businesses who were taking pictures for real estate. They were taking aerial pictures. And then, on the other hand, we found relatively early interest by law enforcement agencies. In the beginning, more local law enforcement agencies from the same state. Then, about two and a half years later, the German government, the Defense Department, became aware of us. And since during that time there was a very, very intensive involvement with the ISAF forces in Afghanistan, they saw a requirement for systems like ours for force protection, and that then in a way shared the same phase as other companies, that then led to significant procurement and to major growth of the company in the following years.
You said that one of your first clients were realtors. I'm assuming that they used your AR-100 series unmanned aerial system. Is that correct?
Yes, these were the early versions of the AR-100, which were called AR-100 without any letters. So later we had the AR-100B, and now we have the AR-100C. The AR-100 at the time was only flying 8 to 12 minutes, but for taking pictures, still pictures, this was okay. And many of them just strapped regular point-and-shoot cameras to it, so commercially available point-and-shoot cameras, which at the time were pretty heavy load for a system like that. But still, it allowed us to gather a lot of experience, because we at the time had very, very close interaction with the users. And we were able to learn from experience relatively quickly. So in a way, it was very beneficial to have some actual users very, very early on.
Were the realtors who used the AR-100 series unmanned aerial system able to increase their sales because of their use?
I would think so, because they had a competitive advantage. And at the time, you have to consider that there was nothing else. So in 2004, we were the only quadcopter which was available anywhere. So pretty much you could say everybody else followed. So I would say they definitely got a competitive advantage.
You also mentioned law enforcement as one of your first clients. What were they using your unmanned aerial systems for?
Law enforcement was in the beginning, for example, looking at forensics and accident photography. So, for example, there was a big pileup on a major highway in Germany that was then photographed and was kind of, at the time, back then it was revolutionary because it was even mentioned in newspapers, that they took aerial pictures. Germany has a little bit of tendency on the Autobahn. Once it's foggy, that there is more accidents, and that was one of the typical fog accidents, which was basically a mass pileup, and that was photographed with one of our systems. That was also kind of a little bit of breakthrough, because through the newspaper articles, other agencies and other potential users got aware of the system, but I would say because of the limited flight time, and also the already implemented still life cameras, that was the nearest they could do. So the idea of providing any kind of, let's say, of any kind of surveillance or something like that, that was far away, because we could fly 8 minutes, and that was definitely not sufficient to do any of this.
AirRobot has been in business since 2004. What projects is AirRobot currently involved with in Germany?
We have a relatively wide range of applications that grew over the years. We see three major segments in the market, and we also are active in all three. We have one is the defense sector, which for many of the, say, established manufacturers is still a major source of income. What has been growing tremendously is the commercial applications. And we see, especially in Germany, we see, since there's no limitations due to the lesser restrictions by the what is called Luftfahrt Bundesamt, which would compare to the FAA here, we see applications, for example, in wind turbine inspection. So we are currently participating in a European Union-funded project which evaluates the use of these systems in the inspection of offshore wind turbines. A very, very challenging project, because wind speeds are usually more than 40 miles or 50 miles per hour. That's why the wind turbines are out there offshore and so effective. But for us, that's a challenge. But on the other hand, it's a very good business case, because corrosion on these costs millions of dollars. And also you're putting lives at stake once you have to rope a crew up there to do the inspection. So this is also why the European Union funds this research project. But that would be one example for a commercial application. We do inspections of flare towers. We have, for example, the world-renowned company BASF, which is a chemical company. They own quite a bit of our systems, and they use them for both. They use them for the inspection of flare towers and their installations, as well as for their hazmat firefighters. We have applications in with the German railways, as well as with the German telecom. There's something very interesting, that is the protection of copper cable, because copper is the new gold, so people tend to steal it. So the German telecommunications company, which is called known as T-Mobile here, so it's the same brand, they're looking at the protection of these copper cables using unmanned aerial systems. And the third one, I almost forgot, is law enforcement. Law enforcement still is a part of our market. And what we see is that there's a variety of uses. Since we can fly a little bit longer, there's now in addition to the forensic photography and accident investigation, there's other uses which these systems are deployed for.
Does Air Robot supply the pilots and the analysts for these applications you mentioned, or does Air Robot supply the unmanned aerial system, and then the group, organization, or business would then be responsible for supplying the crew who will be responsible for the unmanned aerial system?
Usually the customer supplies the pilots as well as the analysis and the experts. We do not understand this as a service company, but as said, we usually do not provide a service.
I was looking over some of the specifications of each of your unmanned aerial system before the show today. While I was reading some of the specifications on your various systems, I saw that the AR-100 series has a safety ring that protects the frame and the propellers, but some of the later models don't. What was the purpose of the safety ring on some of the earlier models and not the later ones?
We have the safety ring on all small systems. So we have the safety ring on all systems which have a gross takeoff weight of about 2 pounds. The safety ring, quite honestly, would not help you on systems which are more than that. It's just a matter of, is it effective or is it not effective? The safety ring has proven to be very effective on the small system, because it's bouncing systems off the wall if you fly too close to wall. On the other hand, depending on what kind of system you use, you will change your concept of operation. So what we find is, since smaller aircraft like the AR-100 can only carry small cameras, usually you will fly very close to your area of interest. It's logical, because a smaller camera cannot look as far. Whereas we find that with the larger aircraft, they have more visual acuity, how you call it, so they can look further out. So you normally would also stay away from any obstacles. You would not fly very close to a wall, or you would not fly very close to any structure to get an image which fits your requirements. So for that, we don't think that it's that important for them to have the safety ring, besides the fact that it's not that effective. What we believe in the future is that autonomy will be key, meaning that instead of working with mechanical, let's say, basically bumpers, we are looking at technology which provides more safety, provides also a little bit of a protection against operator error, because what we find, we have very mature aircraft. So our aircraft have racked up 10,000 flight hours. So in many cases, if there is any kind of an incident, in the overwhelming majority of cases, it is operator error. And so we think that it's very important to give these systems situational awareness, that they are able to detect an operator error before it even happens, and that is what we are actively working towards, so that we have the sensor technology as well as the processing and the autonomy on the systems to rule out any misbehavior or to rule out any accidents which could come from error or from wrong input.
You mentioned autonomy just a moment ago while you were talking. I noticed that, starting with the AR-180 series, that while the overall capabilities stayed the same, such as, while the capabilities changed, capabilities including max altitude, speed, and the load bearing, I saw that other things such as self-correction while in flight and other flight capabilities remained the same and were improved upon. Would you say that your overall goal is a movement to autonomous unmanned aerial systems for certain projects or applications?
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. Yes. Yes.
Do you see, and to follow up with that, do you see the unmanned aerial system community moving towards something like that, and again, for certain applications?
It depends on the application. I would, at this time, completely agree that we have to have a man in the loop. So we have to have a transition which is organic. And I would say one thing which I think is very important to always consider in the industry. Unmanned aerial systems are aviation. So they are both. They are software and they are mechanical engineering and hardware. And in aviation, we have learned one thing. If we board a 747, then we don't spend a minute before we board it in being worried, because we know this is a proven airframe. It's a tested, integrated system, and each incident which happened in the past has been investigated, and each incident led to improvements. Let's say with Boeing, the famous accident over Long Island with the electrical wire leading through the fuel tank. But we are sure that this is not the case anymore. So our industry lives from experience, and it lives from flight hours on the mechanical part. We should not be tempted to say software can fix everything. So an unmanned aerial system is not a gadget. It is not something where we can say, oh, just leave it up to software. We do a bad job on, let's say, we can have less experience on the hardware. We need to consider both. That's why we need to find an organic transition and say, okay, we implement autonomy step by step, without losing sight of the old traditions of aviation, which is flight hours on an aircraft, and is mechanical, solid engineering, and tested systems. So I think there will be a period of time, and the man will always be in the loop before autonomy really takes over and we're doing fully autonomous operations.
One of the specifications that I noticed on your models was the gas and radiation detection sensors. Tell me a little more about the purpose of offering these sensors on your unmanned aerial system.
The purposes of the radiation sensor, and we actually have a pretty nice video demonstrating that, is to be able to detect radiation. The sensor will primarily be deployed from small systems because they have to go pretty close to, let's say, a package, a suspicious package. This goes actually back to 2006, where there was a first project conducted with a German university. They had a very small form factor and lightweight radiation sensor, and they asked us whether we can put it onto an unmanned aerial system. And that was successful, and we got not only a positive negative, we were also able to get an analysis of the radiation. I must say, in the meantime, that system even has been outdated almost, because there is numerous third-party suppliers who provide very, very good sensors. The advantage we have with our systems is that they can carry relatively heavy payloads, so we can carry 3 pounds or 7 pounds, and we can carry them relatively long. So that allows us more flexibility with the implementation of sensors. So at this time, we would not be only limited to the sensor which was developed by the university, so there would be also commercially available third-party sensors. The gas sensor has a similar history. It was actually developed under a program with the German government. That can detect certain gases. It cannot detect all gases. It can detect certain toxic gases and do a positive or negative. So it does not provide an analysis, but it provides positive or negative.
I want to switch topics now and discuss the Federal Aviation Administration. As you know, the FAA is set to release regulations in late 2015. Actually, they're scheduled to release guidelines for those regulations in 2015. Once those regulations are released and we begin to see unmanned aerial systems being integrated into American airspace, what commercial or research applications do you see Air Robot getting involved in?
I think we are already in the process of doing this. So, yes, the rulemaking and then finally publishing the regulation will be a very important step. But the FAA has already started with the acceptance of Section 333 exemption applications to get a process in place where commercial entities can test the equipment and develop CONOPS, the concept of operation. So we really appreciate that, and we actually have the opportunity to be part of some of these. So we think everything is on a very good way. In terms of the implementation into the national airspace, we think that a step-by-step approach is very important, meaning that we have to take into consideration the safety. Safety is a priority, and this is something we completely agree with the FAA. And safety, as said, comes also from experience. It comes from track record. It comes from learning from experience. The second is, and I think that is sometimes, it's not overlooked, but you cannot separate it, is that we need to have the public perception always on our mind, because this is even more important than the FAA regulation. We need, and that would be our goal, that at the time when we implement these systems, that we are at the point that the public sees a true value in these systems. So whether it's for a commercial application or whether it's for an application with first responders. And in a way, the Section 333 exemption application implies this, because when you file for Section 333 with the FAA, you have to prove two things. You have to prove a public interest. That's a very interesting thing. You have to prove public interest. Is it in the public interest to do this? And you have to prove safety. So we have these both parts. The safety is on the part of the FAA, who is responsible for guaranteeing the safety in national airspace. And the public interest is, does the public really see the value of the deployment of these systems? And I think that is the goal we should have as an industry, in convincing people that there is a value for the communities and there's a value for each individual when we deploy these systems, and not only in an economic sense.
We have spoken about some of the potential applications that various businesses and research groups are looking to start in American airspace once regulations are established. How do you feel about companies using unmanned aerial systems for delivery services?
From a technical standpoint, I think that delivery is one of the most problematic. If we look at a step-by-step approach, then maybe the first step is not necessarily flying in densely populated urban areas with very challenging terrain. So if I look, for example, at my own home, then we are surrounded by trees. Actually, if you look me up on Google Earth, you can't see me because we have trees all over, which we like. In summer, it's a nice shade. There's also many, many variables. There could be a car parked in a driveway. There could not be a car parked in a driveway. It can change any time. So I think doing an effective delivery service might really, really require a high amount of situational awareness and autonomy. Whereas there's other applications like infrastructure protection, which would benefit the public. We remember the bridge collapse in Minneapolis. If we can inspect bridges very effectively and we can find out whether they are a risk early on, then we can avoid these. And these are in areas where we have much less challenges, because we can do this in a very controlled environment. The same on other infrastructure. There is infrastructure located in less dense populated areas, and in these areas we could fly and it would not have the same challenges. Also, the just from a technical standpoint, How close do you want to live to the next warehouse from somebody? Because at this time, we are kind of the record holder in flight time and payload. But still, we wouldn't be able to deliver a package of 7 pounds, maybe over 5 kilometers or 10 kilometers, or ask UPS or FedEx what their average weight is for each delivery. They will come up with a much larger number. So we think there is probably things we could do before we enter these operations in very, very densely populated areas.
What commercial applications do you see a future for unmanned aerial systems in?
I would say there is definitely agriculture. Agriculture is, as I said, also very, very few challenges, because where there is agriculture, there is no dense population, so that is easy from a safety standpoint. There is definitely a high value to it. Then there is infrastructure inspection. There's a very high value to it. There is safety and security of, let's say, transportation, any kind of transportation, whether it's by rail, or it could also be by ship. We have the ports, for example, port security, perimeter security. There's quite a bit of applications where companies have a need to deploy these systems. For example, in Europe, there's also the inspection of these chemical plants, and that is something where there's a solid business case in the meantime. There's a company which provides the inspection of a flare tower, but the same company then offers to actually repair the flare tower. So they make a double margin.
Let's talk about public perception in America versus public perception in Germany. How does the German public view unmanned aerial systems and their use commercially?
I would say there are similarities in Germany and the United States. So there is a certain suspicion from the population towards the unmanned aerial systems. Again, we have not really seen a lot of suspicion or a lot of reservations towards commercial applications. So there has never been anybody complaining that, for example, wind turbines are inspected with unmanned aerial systems, or that the BASF, as a large chemical company, does their inspections of their flare towers, as well as they have these systems for their hazmat teams. There have never been complaints, even in the, let's say, neighboring areas of that company. There has not been any discussion about that. Yes, law enforcement is viewed with a little bit more suspicion, but it is not voiced as, let's say, loudly as in the United States currently. It is there, but it is not. It doesn't reflect in, for example, as much legislative action as it does in the United States.
That's all the time we have for our show today. My guest has been Mr. Thomas Meyer. He is the president of the U.S. subsidiary Air Robot. Mr. Meyer, I want to thank you for being on our show today, and I hope that you will come back and visit with us again very soon.
Thank you. My pleasure.
The views and opinions expressed on our podcast are those of the authors, producers, and our guests. They do not automatically reflect the views or opinions of any organization or government agency that are guests on our podcast, nor do they reflect the official policy or position of any U.S. government agency. If you have information that you would like to have discussed on our show or would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us on our website, uas-today.com, or email us at podcast@uas-today.com. Thanks for listening.